the middle class is a powerful idea in the United States, shaping our economic policies and, in many ways, our political conversations. And there are more than a few ways to measure exactly who is part of it. Our next guest researches the middle class through the lens of wealth and how we build it. Her work finds a large gap between black and white Americans when it comes to reaching a middle class level of wealth. There are a lot of reasons for that, including the uneven impact of student debt on college graduates. Fenaba Otto is the Lorna Jorgensen-Wendt Associate Professor of Money, Relationships, and Equality in UW-Madison's Department of Consumer Science. Fenaba, welcome to Central Time.
Hello. It's a pleasure to be here this afternoon. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I understand that there are different ways economists and others try to measure middle class status. You look at it through the lens of wealth. Could you talk about how and why you do that?
Yes. So we believe that wealth is the probably the best economic indicator of understanding class status in the United States. So at a very basic level, you know, I'm calling it wealth, but it also is in capturing net wealth, which is the difference between what one owns, so their assets minus their liabilities, right? So what they owe. And it captures the full, you know, household balance sheet. But it also allows us information about access, right? So when we're talking about access, like how much, what is one's access to power, to privilege, to prestige? How much access do you have to resources, and when do you have access to those resources across one's life, and are the ability to pass on resources and secure resources intergenerationally? So it's so much more than just an economic indicator, right? And as you already referenced, I also look at this with regard to wealth inequality. And so we believe that using a wealth-based metric for understanding middle-class status provides a clearer picture for understanding the wealth positioning of Black American households.
Before we dig into that a little more, just I want to compare and contrast other ways to look at middle-class status. We could think about income, but I guess if we did that, a person making $50,000 but, say, having no debt, at a person making $50,000 and having $100,000 of debt, those are people in two very different situations, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, these comparisons are important, especially at times like this, like we're in currently, in which we have a lot of economic precarity and financial instability due to the global pandemic that's been happening and the potential for a recession if people lose their access to their income and they don't have a private social safety net such as wealth to draw upon during these times, then they can, you know, experience quickly downward mobility. So this is the example that you gave is exactly right. So if you lose your access to your income, but you have some wealth to draw upon to kind of weather the economic instability, then that household is going to fare a little bit better than a household that doesn't have access, but even may have debt. And when that debt comes due and you can't pay it off, you're especially precarious, right? Your financial situation is highly, you know, mm-hmm. you know, poor. It's pretty bad. So, yeah.
Now, we know, I think we have a sense that there are different kinds of disparities of income and wealth between Black and white Americans here in Wisconsin in particular, maybe. When we look at it through this lens of wealth, our assets, less our liabilities, our debts, our access and things like that, what do we see?
Well, what we see is, so what we do, you know, in the work that we've been doing is just kind of dividing up the wealth distribution into quintiles, and we're just going to assign like the middle three quintiles as middle class. When we do that, and then we start to, you know, we say stratify or disaggregate by race, we see what we refer to as this lower ladder phenomenon, which is that even, so we can start at the top wealth quintile, the median wealth of Black households who sit at the top wealth quintile, so who are, you know, doing fairly well, their median wealth is less than the wealth profiles of white households who are in the next wealth quintile. So what this translates into is that we don't see their wealth positioning translating into the same benefits, outcomes as whites who are in similar wealth positionings. And this, you know, this can have real implications for what we see, how things play out on a day-to-day basis or in times when there is a recession or economic downturns, right? So why do certain households, why do Black households experience higher rates of downward mobility, for example? Because, you know, in the median or the typical household does not have the same amount of resources than in comparison to white households.
We're talking to Fenneba Otto, associate professor in the Department of Consumer Science at UW-Madison, looking at what it means to be in the middle class, measuring it by wealth, which includes factoring in things like debt, and finding out some of the disparities between Black and white America and how we got there. And Fenneba, if I read your research correctly, part of the story here is a generational story. The parents who can't pay for their kids' college, well, that next generation might be in a similar position to them. Can you talk about how these things translate over generations?
Yeah. So the work that we have been doing is really trying to highlight or shed light on the relationships between racial wealth disparities within our society and its connection to what we're seeing, especially among recent cohorts of young adults, growing student debt disparities. So what that means is if we have these wealth disparities, parents cannot provide the same resources, cannot transfer financial resources, can't help pay for college, and their students therefore have to take on debt in order to pursue higher education, pursue a college degree. If you have that debt and you're entering into young adulthood, it takes a little while longer to pay that debt down. I can also get into the high rates of default and delinquency that we see amongst Black college borrowers. And those processes end up delaying future wealth accumulation and also are contributing to growing debt disparities.
Can you talk more about the default situation for Black Americans on student loan debt?
Yeah, so what we actually see in the data is that independent of college completion status, Black borrowers have the highest rates of default and delinquency on their student loan debt. We actually see that they default pretty early on in the repayment process, which is associated with having higher loan balances. And, you know, we know from work that we do on, you know, consumer finances is that these defaults and delinquencies can ding one's credit, right? And so there are both short-term and long-term effects of the default and delinquency. As I already mentioned, the long-term effects can be delays in accumulation of future assets, but it also can mean that it makes borrowing more costly. If you want to eventually buy that house or, you know, buy a car, if you have things on one's credit or low credit scores, the implications are very real, you know, and materialize very quickly on one's balance sheet, one household's balance sheet. And it's disproportionately we see happening among Black student borrowers.
We're talking to Fenneba Otto right now, associate professor of consumer science at UW-Madison, looking at her research on how we measure the middle class in America and racial gaps in wealth accumulation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you feel like it means to be middle class? Does it make sense to you to use wealth as opposed to something like, say, income or profession or job as a way to measure it? What do you see as barriers to growing personal wealth? Are things like debts, student loan debt, or other kinds of debt limiting your own financial situation, your ability to maybe make a better life for your kids? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Fenneba Otto, associate professor of money, relationships, and equality at UW-Madison, looking at how we measure the middle class and racial gaps we see in personal wealth and things like student debt. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think constitutes being middle class? Do you think it's gotten harder for people to build personal wealth? Has student debt affected your ability to gain wealth and maybe become or stay middle class? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Feniba, you used the word precarious earlier. We've had two big economic shocks in just recent memory, the Great Recession, and then the economic shutdown that came along with COVID-19. How does that affect different groups differently? People with that firmer grasp, I guess, on middle class, and people who are just kind of barely hanging on?
Yeah, so it affects them differently because we see when we look at the data, the concentration of where people fall in the middle class to vary very differently. So if we look at Black households, they're more likely to fall into that lower quintile, right? So if you have just a few months, let's just say just a few months of emergency savings, given the current pandemic, it's kind of, we're waiting on a vaccine, for example, right? And so we're not quite sure how long this might last. And so if you only have, you know, the standard 3 to 6 months of emergency savings to help you weather this current period, you may already have either experienced downward mobility or may be very close to not being able to meet your bills or your needs. And therefore, we will see this shifting in who can actually constitute or fall into the middle class, this middle class criteria. So that concentration varies by race and ethnicity, whereas we, you know, like I said, Black Americans are much more likely to be falling down into the lower wealth quintiles as compared to white Americans, who are a little bit more evenly distributed across the wealth quintiles.
We had a call from Frank in Milwaukee who couldn't stay on the line. Frank was wondering if you had any ideas about what the experience was like for the Latino population. We've been talking about Black and white so far. Do we have data to work with on that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I would say we know a little bit, but we always need more and better data to help us learn more about what is happening. I will say that their wealth profiles tend to fall in between Black Americans, which tend to be the lowest, and white Americans, which tend to be larger than Hispanic or Latinx populations. So they are also, their amounts of student loan debt that they're acquiring is growing. And I think it'll be very important to see what happens, especially during this moment, with regard to college completion and their ability to not accumulate lots of debt as we navigate this moment. But yeah, that's a great question.
We also heard from Paul on Facebook who writes, middle class seems to mean two jobs and carrying a lot of debt to look like you're living the same lifestyle your grandparents lived, with one job and everything paid in cash. I don't know if this is something you look at, Feniba. Is there something there where what it takes to have what we think of as a middle class lifestyle, the goalposts have moved over time?
Yeah, and so I think this is makes like that point makes the case for why we should be looking at wealth to define middle class status, because I think it captures both notions about what it takes to be middle class with the realities of the economic situation that they find themselves in. Other terms that you often maybe hear are like the fragile middle class. Why is this? Why are they so highly over leveraged? Why do they have so much debt at this moment? You know, this is, if we look and we start teasing out, you know, we're not going to be able to capture that just by looking at income or just by looking at occupational status, which are pretty, you know, the kind of conventional or standard measures of socioeconomic status that academics tend to use. So we think that, you know, we need to start thinking a little bit more broadly and incorporating measures of debt and you know, the value of one's assets to kind of understand what it means. And I think this categorization actually allows us to group a larger number of households into our understanding of what it means middle class. You know, oftentimes we hear a lot of people saying, I consider myself middle class. I consider myself middle class, but if you look at their, you know, their household balance sheet, it could vary quite differently. and I think that the wealth definition actually speaks to this.
With college debt, it seems like there's a catch-22 here where we know there's a wage premium for having that college degree, and we often think of the college degree as a road to social mobility, but for a lot of people, it sounds like it's a road to debt and maybe limiting the room for mobility. How do we sort that out?
It is increasingly becoming so. That is the case. I think that's why this is an important part of the conversation when we are talking about what it means for students and their families navigating college these days, and how it's how student debt is becoming increasingly a larger share of one's wealth portfolio, right? Like we spoke about earlier, the idea of wealth being intergenerational, the debt that a student takes on can have long-lasting impacts for not only themselves but their families. And I think this is why we can't minimize the growing importance of what it means, because yes, if we look at, again, the conventional measures such as income, we do see continued returns to that college education paying off in the long term. But if we expand that definition to incorporate wealth-based metrics, then for some certain populations, which tend to have higher rates of, who take on average, higher average loan debt or loan balances in order to pursue that education, then it's going to not necessarily lead to higher wealth. And that tends to be disproportionately Black American and Black borrowers.
Feniba, in our last minute and a half or so, can you point us toward, I guess, possible solutions to make that precarious middle-class existence less precarious?
Yeah, so I tend to focus a little bit more on student debt, and I'm very much in the conversations around how we need to think about how to decrease the amount that debt that households are accumulating, as well as help them pay it off quicker. So thinking about, you know, income-based repayment programs, thinking about, do we need to think about debt cancellation for certain populations, especially those who are not seeing the returns on their education, such as those who may have had attended for-profit institutions? And then how do we also think about regulating markets that may be engaging in discriminatory practices, such as real estate markets, loan lending credit markets as well? So really think we have to think about reducing the debt, but also increasing the assets that these households are interacting with.
And briefly, Feniba, what are you going to be looking at next in your own research?
Oh, I'm continuing actually to look at the middle class as they weather the current pandemic. I'm also doing some new work on understanding what it might mean to be working class as we see changes in the future of work and growing occupational segmentation. So yeah, I'm excited about that work as well.
Feniba,
always looking with a lens to debt and wealth. Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Feniba Otto is an associate professor of money, relationships, and equality at UW-Madison's Department of Consumer Science. She talked with us today about her research on racial gaps in the middle class and how student debt can affect college graduates. Lawyers for Kyle Rittenhouse, the 17-year-old charged with killing two protesters in Kenosha, told an Illinois judge Friday that they would fight extradition charges to Wisconsin. Rittenhouse has become something of a hero to some on the right. Sean Johnson reports on those calling him a patriot.
After Kenosha police shot Jacob Blake, a Black man, in the back multiple times, the city erupted into protest. On August 25th, Kyle Rittenhouse made the 20-mile trip to Kenosha from his home in Antioch, Illinois. Rittenhouse, a lifeguard and a vocal supporter of police, said he was there to protect a local business and offer medical help if needed. He walked through the crowds that night with an AR-15 rifle strapped to his chest. What happened that night is disputed and will eventually be hashed out in court, but a full-scale public relations blitz is underway by some of Rittenhouse's supporters. A group called the Fight Back Foundation released a dramatic video compilation of cell phone footage from the night of the shootings. It claims Rittenhouse fired his gun only after being chased and attacked. The narrator speaks of Rittenhouse being sacrificed by politicians.
But it's not Kyle Rittenhouse they're after. Their endgame is to strip away the constitutional right of all citizens to defend our communities, our personal property, our lives, and the lives of our loved ones.
Rittenhouse's cause got the attention of conservative media figures. Here's former Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi on Fox News.
What's it coming to in these liberal cities when teenagers have to go out there to try to provide aid?
Last week, conservative commentator Michelle Malkin joined Rittenhouse's mom and lawyer at an event for Republican Party women in Waukesha County. Malkin tweeted that they received a standing ovation. The Fight Back Foundation says it's raised almost $2 million for Rittenhouse. The group's chairman is Lynn Wood, a prominent attorney who made a name for himself representing Richard Jewell in the 1996 Olympic bombing case. Longtime Wisconsin defense lawyer Dean Strang, who is not involved in this case, says the teen's attorneys may well argue self-defense.
But it has nothing to do, in the first instance, with being a hero, and has everything to do with whether you'll be held responsible for killing other people or you won't.
Kyle Rittenhouse is charged with first-degree reckless homicide in the death of 36-year-old Joseph Rosenbaum and first-degree intentional homicide in the death of 26-year-old Anthony Huber. Huber's surviving partner, Hannah Giddings, is among a group of plaintiffs who this week filed a civil lawsuit against Rittenhouse and a Kenosha militia group. In a YouTube clip, she talks about Huber.
He did not deserve that. He was a good human being.
The plaintiffs are also suing Facebook for publicizing the militia group's call to arms. John Pierce is Rittenhouse's lead attorney. He told the conservative news site Breitbart that his client had a God-given right to be in the city that night.
I will tell you, and there's no doubt about this, that if every law-abiding American showed up in the city that they love with an AR-15, the chaos would stop immediately.
University of Arizona sociology professor Jennifer Carlson says, the Rittenhouse case aside, it does appear more people are embracing violence as a solution in 2020. Carlson has researched gun politics for the past decade. In interviews with gun sellers this year, she's found more people who feel like institutions have broken down. Instead of the ballot box, they're turning to boxes of bullets.
People are beginning to really think that we have reached the point of no return with regard to violence. And whether we have or not, if people believe that we have, that is very troubling.
Kyle Rittenhouse remains in custody in Lake County, Illinois. He's due back in court on October 9th for another status update on his extradition case. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
New documentary with several Wisconsin connections is hoping to shine a light on problems and solutions around overcrowding in animal shelters. Kimberly Resch is from Wisconsin. She's executive producer of the new documentary, Rescue Story, Saving Companion Animals. Kim, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
Amanda and Marcus Wrights are also with us. They're featured in the documentary for their project Happily Ever After, based in Northeast Wisconsin. Amanda is founder of the group. Amanda, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And Marcus is director of branding and development for Happily Ever After. Marcus, thanks for being with us.
You bet. We brought the dogs with, too. I don't know if you're picking that up or not, but they're
not
here.
Yet, but I'm looking forward to it. If there's ever a time to hear a dog in the background of an interview, this might be it. Well, Kim, let's start with a problem you lay out in the film. Overcrowding and euthanization, lots of it in our American system. Talk about the scope of the problem before we get into what you spend most of the time in your documentary looking at, the solutions.
No problem. Well, what we've heard is that there's 1.5 million animals, roughly, that are euthanized yearly due to overcrowding and underfunding in traditional shelters. Obviously, people are always looking for animals to have homes. And in the message of the film, the goal was to shed light on why it's happening to begin with. So we were trying to begin with the end in mind. And when we asked Shaman Motion Pictures, who produced our films with us, to go and find some of the companies that and some of the organizations that we really felt were doing a great job at mitigating this problem, Happily Ever After was one of them, and along with some other ones. But Happily Ever After has done an exponentially amazing job, especially in Wisconsin, in helping to find animals' homes and in helping mitigate this problem. So that's what I would say at first.
I want to listen to a clip from the video. You spent time here in Wisconsin, of course, and elsewhere in the country, including on the Gulf Coast of Texas. I want to listen to a Nueces County Animal Control volunteer named Lisa Bachholt.
They're not being euthanized because the staff wants to. The problem is there's nowhere to put the animal. And everybody says, well, can't you just send them to another place? Well, of course we can if there's another place that will take them. And what people don't realize is there is not some magic bus that takes them to some magic place. And we don't just ship them here, there, and everywhere. We don't just go out front and hail down a cab or call UPS. There has to be a process and a rescue organization. And wherever we send them, they have to have a place for them. But the sad part is they blame the shelters, and they shouldn't do that.
And Kim, this is a theme I hear from a lot of people in the documentary involved in various aspects of this. It's not just a problem at this shelter or that shelter. People are looking for bigger system-wide solutions, right?
That's absolutely. I don't think that anyone likes a broken system. And so our job at Conscious Content Collective is to create education and awareness on issues that matter to humanity and to the animals. And so basically the film tells the story of what you can do. Let's discuss. We do it in chapters. We talk about what the problem is. We introduce the characters. We show, and of course, we're always about hope. Everything that we do at Conscious Content has the ending of hope. And this story has a hopeful ending, which is great. But there's still a lot of work to be done. And then Marcus and Amanda can also shed more light on that.
Yeah, I want to bring this home to Wisconsin now. Amanda, can you tell us how your organization, Happily Ever After, got started?
Back in around 2005, 2006, it became apparent to me that there was there was a problem within the shelter system. About one out of every two animals that were entering the shelters across the U.S. were being needlessly euthanized. So I wanted to bring an alternative message, not just to our area, but to places across Wisconsin and the U.S. to show people that if you take killing off the table, there can be other solutions to saving lives.
And Marcus, talk about some of the ways that you at Happily Ever After have done, those alternatives that you've found over the years.
Yeah, so we kind of, I guess, stepping up just a level on that, we look at our vision statement. It's that we want to create a world where the life of every companion animal matters, every single one. And if we step that down into what our mission looks like on a daily basis, it's to provide a loving home to every companion animal that enters our care with a lifetime guarantee. So if for whatever reason they find a home and that home doesn't work out, we're here for them as an ultimate safety net, and they become part of our family. Additionally, if they're unable to find a home, we're here to be that family for them as long as they need it, no questions asked. So that's our vision and mission. And we get down into our work and we really focus on five pillars. We have a very strong and forward-looking adoption program, pairing that with some community-based education, looking kind of across the spectrum from youth to adults and elderly, every kind of link in between there to make sure that people understand how they can plug in and be a part of the solution. And then we also have a focus on spay-neuter, so providing some external programs with our veterinary partners to afford people the opportunity to have that service performed on pets where they need help and assistance financially, as well as making sure that every pet that comes through our doors and goes out into the public is spayed and neutered. And then the last two, I think, are probably the two that differentiate our services to some extent. We do have in addition to our adoption center location here in Green Bay, Wisconsin, we do have a sanctuary location in Marion, just about 50 miles northwest. And there we provide rehabilitation services and sanctuary or lifetime care. And what that rehabilitation component really boils down to is it's an opportunity for animals that need help and need time to either reconstruct or even establish trust initially, or maybe they're working through some things behaviorally. That's just a place that we can provide a very consistent and stable routine for animals every day and give them a place to call home for as long as they need it. So if that means that we're unable to find homes, we become that home for them for the duration of their life. So, it's not uncommon for us to see animals that we've worked on for, you know, a couple of years be placed into homes. In fact, this past weekend, we had a couple very successful stories that stem back 3 or 4 years of time mm-hmm. that we've had.
We're talking about efforts to provide happier homes for shelter animals in the United States. Amanda and Marcus Wrights are with us with the Wisconsin organization Happily Ever After, and they are featured in a documentary produced by our other guest, Kim Resch. She's from Wisconsin. The documentary is called Rescue Stories Saving Companion Animals. You can join in, by the way, at 800-642-1234 if you have a story to share about adopting a shelter animal or maybe fostering one or working with them in whatever capacity, 800-642-1234. Another organization highlighted in the film is called Four Paws to Freedom. It helps veterans get matched up and train their own service companion animals. I want to give a listen to this. This is Terry Sandoff, a founder of the group, and Paul Dewey, a Vietnam War vet, and Sethi Jervin, a retired police officer. Here's a listen.
It's that bond that we create, and that bond happens because they're training them, they're working with them, they're with them all the time. They create that bond, and they become a unit, and that unit just works. When the person's down, the dog's there. When the dog's down, the person's there. It's pretty magical.
sometimes in life we have to step out where we're not familiar, and taking in an animal, sometimes we go, oh, I can't deal with it. But sometimes that's the piece of your life you really should take a risk on.
I don't know that it will always be this way. They say that you can recover from PTSD. I would hope that that would happen. But until then, I have faith. I walk with faith every day.
And Faith is the name of her rescue dog. Kim, you highlight this and also a literacy group that uses dogs, shelter dogs. Can you talk about how it's not just ultimately about helping the pets themselves? The circle completes and it helps a lot of people along the way.
It does. Well, there's a lot of disabilities that really aren't visible. And in a previous film, Light in the Darkness, we really talk about grief, trauma, and PTSD. And we have a section inside of this film where we talk about PTSD being such a widespread problem. And now with everything that's happened since March, people are really starting to feel isolated. And there's a plethora of other things that we can talk about, which Marcus and Amanda can talk about in a little while as to how animals really help with that isolation aspect. But we understand that the post-traumatic stress disorder, it's a broader problem. And if we're going to talk about stats, on average, 22 vets die by suicide every day. And those are just the numbers that are reported. They're not really the numbers. So the 4 Paws 2 Freedom program, where veterans come and they train their own dog and they become a service animal, I think the dogs are being saved, but I think they're saving their lives. So there's this beautiful, you were talking about a full circle moment. I really think that it's a very equal energy relationship. And the other thing I'd really like them to talk about, Marcus and Amanda, is how the disposition of the animals that go into service like this and where they come from. So I'll just leave it with that because they have so much more to offer.
Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about that, Amanda, the disposition of the pets, as Kim was saying?
Yeah. So, you know, it's almost as though they realize that they've been saved, and they are so eternally grateful to their adopters and the people that are in their lives who, you know, have given them this second chance, or maybe it's a third or a fourth chance. And, you know, they are so willing to share of themselves and of their heart. And they do that in the different ways that are shown in this documentary, whether it's, you know, serving a veteran who needs that companionship and that company and that support, or allowing children to participate in a literacy program and helping them gain confidence to read. Or it might be an autistic child in a home that we've adopted an animal into that allows this animal allows that child to truly feel comfort and safety. And that child starts to blossom into who they're meant to be too. You know, so across the board, pets are saving people at the same time that the people are saving them.
We are talking with Amanda and Marcus Wrights of the Northeast Wisconsin Area Rescue Organization Happily Ever After. That's featured in a film, Rescue Story, Saving Companion Animals. Kimberly Resch, also with us, executive producer of that documentary. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you foster? Have you adopted a rescue animal? Do you work with a shelter in the area? Tell us your story at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll hear from a couple of you coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about rescue animals with Kimberly Resch, executive producer to the new documentary Rescue Story, Saving Companion Animals, and Amanda and Marcus Wrights from the Animal Sanctuary and Adoption Organization in northeastern Wisconsin. It's called Happily Ever After. It's featured in the documentary. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Nick is with us in Green Bay. Nick, hi.
Hi, I adopted my first dog when I lived on KSR Air Force Base, like Yale Air Force Base up in the UP. Mm-hmm. And that was a black lab. The mother was so vicious you couldn't see her. So I was a little bit hesitant, but that was the best dog I've ever had. I had him for 17 years, and I cried like a baby when I put him down. But after that, I won't buy another dog from a breeder. I've never bought a dog from a breeder, but my two dogs I got now came from the South, and I guess they got a lot of problems with strays, but I'll never buy like a dog from a breeder. Always going to be rescued because they're awesome dogs. And this is the best show you've ever had on here, so
Nick, thank you so much for sharing your story. And Marcus, it seems like people who do get pets from shelters end up being like Nick, pretty darn happy about it.
Oh, for sure. For sure. And, you know, earlier, just one quick additive to what we were talking about earlier. We're seeing right now a huge spike in adoptions this year. Right now, we're actually tracking up about 40%. So I think that companionship and what people are craving right now, it all kind of comes together and is something very special.
And Amanda, Nick had mentioned pets being available, needing to find homes in the South and moving elsewhere. And that's part of what you do and other groups in this organization saying, okay, if this one area has more pets available than people to adopt them, finding places, looking further afield than the local county.
Yeah, it's all about, you know, networking and working together in order to get the animals where they need to be to get adopted. And so if our numbers are good at saving lives up here in Wisconsin, if we can help those in Texas or Tennessee or Florida or California, wherever it is, to save more lives together, that's what this is all about. This is what we should be doing, to work together and, as a country in order to change these numbers and make things better for everybody.
Nick, thanks for calling in. Cheryl joins us now in Neshota. Cheryl, hi.
Hi. My husband and I were driving through Tennessee in the mountains, and a little beagle puppy ran across the road out in the mountains, and I insisted my husband stop, which he did, and we went back, and that little puppy was laying on his back peeing. He was so happy to get some help, and we picked him up. We brought him back to Wisconsin, and my husband's friend adopted him, and he lived for almost 25 years. We had been in Buford, Georgia, so we named him Buford. We took him to a vet there, and they said, there's so many stray dogs running in the streets down there. The vet assistant had like 15 dogs at her house. They don't actually even pay for shelters. They're all funded by donations. It's
Cheryl,
sad, but it's happy. He got a break.
I'm glad you were able to help Buford out, Cheryl. Thanks so much for sharing that story with us. And in making this documentary, Kim, Cheryl's story, not unique. I mean, I think one of the people you talked to, literally one of the dogs she talked about, she just found stray in her own neighborhood.
Yes. Well, when we were filming in Texas, we didn't realize that 220,000 animals get euthanized because they're found strayed. And so we knew that that was too many animals. And fortunately, the woman that was just on the phone, bless her. That's amazing. That's a beautiful story. And we want more of those stories. But in the film, we try to go to the root problem. Why is this happening? And how can we reallocate some of the responsibility so that way it doesn't happen to begin with?
Now, our caller there kind of fostered that dog that she had found, that puppy, because someone else ended up adopting. Can you, Marcus, talk a little bit about that, the role of foster caregivers for dogs and cats?
Yeah, absolutely. If you have room in your home and room in your heart to help a pet, even on a short-term or temporary basis, it's one of the most impactful things you can do to help a shelter organization. It relieves space from a resource perspective. It adds knowledge into the community in terms of how to care for pets and what their needs are. And that it fosters additional conversation that brings others into the fold to help solve this problem. And it's definitely an important part of the overall rescue equation.
And can I add that, like, for instance, we have a transport coming up really shortly here, and in order for us to say yes to some of those on the other end, you know, we have to have fosters that say yes up here first. So when, you know, we get a list, we'll actually make a post out to our fosters and say, here's who we could potentially bring up into our care. But before we do that, we need your help. So those people can make a huge difference in allowing us to increase our capacity, our life-saving capacity, to get them up here. And then they in turn go and tell their friends and their neighbors about these animals, and it helps them get placed. Just like the nice woman on the call that took this dog up, she fostered it essentially and found another home. And that's, you know, that helps the network grow even more than just a shelter or rescue.
Let's go to another caller now. Arlene is with us in New Berlin. Arlene, hi.
Good morning, or good afternoon. The reason I'm calling is all my life, and actually my married life, I've had dogs. 4 children, 3 dogs, and a husband. I want to know, why is it that I'm penalized because I'm older?
Is it harder for older people, Amanda, do you think, to be able to adopt a pet? Is there some kind of bias against them if they're adopting?
I can't speak to other organizations, but I can definitely speak to Happily Ever After and say that, you know, we have adopters from 18 years old to, I believe the most recent one was 93 or 97. And so we definitely, you know, we can see that doesn't matter what age group you're in as an adopter, if you have love in your heart and the ability to take care of an animal, you know, that's all that counts.
Thanks a lot for that call. Good luck, Arlene. Just a couple minutes left. I want to make sure we get to a couple things. Marcus, if someone, it sounds like you really need foster caregivers. If there's somebody out there listening who says, yeah, that's me, how can they get in touch? How can they become a foster caregiver?
Yeah, for sure. So we've got a couple different avenues by which people can follow along our journey and what's going on and how to help. If they want to go out to our website is HEA, as in happily ever after, nokill.org. So it's HEA, nokill.org. There is a foster page right on there. And that can get them in and get the process started. Additionally, following along with our social media channels, both Facebook and Instagram, at HEA, nokill, will be places people can find us on those channels. And those are areas that certainly help us build community. And at the end of the day, that's what this is all about, is building and expanding a community so we can help to solve this problem that has great momentum behind it.
And Kim, briefly getting back to the point of hope, you wrap up the documentary saying there are lots of ways, big and small, that people can help out. Can you touch on a couple of those we might not have gotten to in just our last 30 seconds or so?
Yeah, I think so. There's quite a few. You can donate to a shelter, which we really encourage people to do because they're professionals and they can take care of the animals. You can get the animals through adoption or where you can foster them so they can find their forever home. Let's see here. What else would I say? You can participate in events. And I would say donating is the biggest thing. We have an event that's coming up in October 4th, and they'll have the most beautiful little envelopes where you can either buy, donate online, or you can come to an event and you can donate in person to help them on their mission.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to our guests today, Kimberly Resch, executive producer of the new documentary Rescue Story, Saving Companion Animals. Also with us, Amanda Reitz and Marcus Reitz. They are both with the Animal Sanctuary and Adoption Organization in northeastern Wisconsin called Happily Ever After. Green Bay premiere of the film, by the way, this weekend, sold out, but you can find more info about it and the organizations we talked about through a link at our website at WPR.org/Central Time.